This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Good evening. Welcome to the Money Talk Show. This is your station for talking business. AM 790. I'm Steve Bove, certified financial planner professional. My assistant tonight, Nathan Bove, soon to be certified financial planner professional. This is important that we express our designation that way. It's a legal requirement, believe it or not. We are very expressly told not to refer to ourselves as CFPs. We are certified financial planner professionals. Just means, unlike a broker of yesteryear, we're the people that drive you crazy with 1,000 questions before we'll tell you what we think about what to do with your money. I believe in the long run that's the best way to handle it most of the time. There are still, of course, a place for an isolated trade or two that's not involving your core money. But I have always believed that core money should be handled differently than speculative money, meaning money for your retirement is core money. That's why we're having an overhaul, as we speak, of the laws in our country from the Department of Labor regarding how professional people can offer you services on a retirement account. So many of my clients have gotten a letter recently and been hearing from my office about this. And I think it's a good thing. It's forced the industry to create models and programs that are very, very cost effective. And we're not quite there yet. But we're moving towards the point where people with smaller money can expect it to get some of the similar treatments that people with a lot of money get. And in the past, that wasn't the case. You had to have, you know, I remember, you know, 20 years ago, it was $1 million and up, had private management. I now do it at 250 and higher. Some of the models that are coming out now for people with smaller accounts, those people are just as important to all of us, to our society, to our businesses. We need a way to help them. So if you're getting confusing letters from your brokerage company or investment people telling you that you have to meet with them soon to discuss how these new laws are affecting your account, that's the truth. In this skeptical world, I thought it might be helpful to share that. And if you're happy with the people that you've been working with, I would suggest you proceed with them at their suggestion of what they have to offer you. And the intention is to get out of the commission game, so that no one in the financial business can ever give you advice that's based on what's best for them instead of what's best for you. And so investment portfolios that are based on a fee basis for compensation only don't allow for that. We went 80, 90, 100 years in the financial business, trusting everyone in the financial business on the sales side to do what was prudent and best for the customer, and I believe most do and have. Unfortunately, there's been enough stories, and we've all heard them, of other bad behavior. And because money, and retirement money especially, is so important, only your health and the people you love are probably more important than your money. But it's a very important thing, not number one in life, but it's surely on the list somewhere of importance. And so if you're getting this type of correspondence, this is going on across the industry. And if you decide to not stay with your account where it is, you're going to run into the same challenges elsewhere very soon, if not right away. So I suggest if you're happy with the people you've been working, where your account has been, and you get a letter like this, talk to them and see what they can offer you to continue with them, because you had a pattern with them that's been pleasant already. And Nathan, who joins me on Wednesday night to talk about financial history, is actually the bird dog in my office on this program. And any words, Nathan, on this? You've been at this for a few weeks now.
Yeah, I think the big thing you mention all the time, that the one of the things the law is trying to do is push out commissions out of retirement accounts, which is good. But the other thing that it's trying to do now is really try to bring expenses and fees that the client pays up to the forefront. Right now,
so you can see it.
Right now, if you have a brokerage IRA, there are fees associated with holdings, like especially mutual funds, but you don't ever see the expenses. They're built into the mutual fund. So, for example, if the mutual fund you have has an expense ratio of 1.5%, the first 1.5% return that the fund makes that year, they retain that to pay their staff. And they usually have a big head honcho who's managing the money and who makes millions and millions of dollars. And he has a whole staff, and they've got to pay those people somehow.
And that's kind of fading out, the superstar manager getting paid billions.
Right.
It's more indexes and things like that today.
Right. There's a big, big debate you can have with and many people in the business on which is the better way to go, an actively managed fund or a passively managed fund. And when you look at the returns of these two different styles, it depends on what kind of time frame you look at, but they kind of trade back and forth. You know,
they do. And they always will.
It's not a clear-cut winner or loser.
When the markets are infallibly up, clients can look at a statement and say, what do I need him for? When they're infallibly down, they think the opposite. What would I do without someone to talk to at a time like this? So it's a double-edged sword.
Personally, me, if it's hard to justify the active management as being that much gainful, and as we said, it's depending on how you look at it and which window of time you look at it, I would tend to go with more passively stuff in general. Not there may be some other specific things.
Yeah, these are going to be counts on the smaller side, so I think the passive is a good way of going, very cost effective.
Right, right. But I think there are some things if you like, for example, if you're going to invest in something that's more esoteric. Where it's more harder, it's the knowledge is tough. Like, for example, if I wanted to invest in something that was only investing in companies in emerging markets, for example, right? You might want to have a qualified person who's looking at these individual stocks.
Small cap stocks are still that
way. Yeah, exactly. Small cap stocks is another good example, right?
But not large cap. We'd rather have an index.
Yeah, exactly. If you're going to invest in a mutual fund that's investing in companies like Apple and Microsoft and GE and AT&T, you know, how much skill do you need to pick giant companies like that?
It's obvious who they are.
Right, right. So that's a perfect example. That's one I should have been going
small
to.
Caps. Small emerging caps. Emerging markets is the other category, I think.
Yeah, small caps, I think, are good to have an active manager, but the large cap fund, I don't see it, you know, the value.
It gets to the core of our field, which you're learning now in year three, is that everything is complicated.
Sure.
There is nothing simple.
Nothing's black and white.
No, and there are different viewpoints on things, and some things aren't right or wrong. They're just different. So finding people to work with that have a similar view of the world as you is a good part of it. I mean, the clients that I had a meeting with one today. He's been with me for so long, many, many years, and I just enjoyed the meeting so much. She's probably listening. She's a riot. She knows what I'm talking about. But it's just that it's such a nice experience to know people that well and that long. And part of this no commission business is also going to slow people down and make them have more information, know more about the client. Because in the future, to be in the financial business, you're really not going to be a salesman at all. In the beginning of my career, that's what I was. It was just get people's attention, get them in the office, and bend their ear, tell them what you do. It's very different now. So the barrier to entry has gone up an awful lot. So I think if you were prior to these rules, any individual could probably get started in the financial business rather easily. If you could be patient about the income, you could do it on your own. But in the future, with these new rules, you're going to have to go into an office that's already established. Starting a can you imagine with the new rules trying to start from scratch?
Nope, not a chance.
I don't know how you could do it.
No.
You have to start when you were seven, and didn't even any income.
Right.
Because if you build accounts on a fee basis one at a time, it takes decades to ever get to a point where you can make a living from it. So it's going to be like other professions, a steeper barrier to entry, which I think is going to be good because that part of it is going to keep a lot of the wrong people out of the field.
One of the clients asked me recently when they opened the account, they had a modest balance of $20,000, and it was going into this new model where it's a fee-based only. And they said, now I understand that my expenses are going to be about 1.3% a year, but how much are you making? And I said, well, to be honest with you, I'm going to get paid about $30 a year. That's literally me as the advisor of that. I mean, the firm has to take some as overhead for the to pay the bills.
But that's already built into the 1.3.
Yes, of course. But as me as the advisor, I mean, to think about how many bodies you would have to take in at that level to make a career is really
that's why I'm saying
daunting.
To build it from scratch is almost going to be impossible now. But I'll tell you what, to build an accounting firm from scratch is almost impossible too. Because you can't hang in there long enough to put the bricks in place. You got a wife saying, hey, man, we need a paycheck over here, honey. We got kids to feed, so it's very difficult. However, in the serious professions, a higher barrier to entry is one of the best protections for consumers there is. Really, the creepy person who we don't want in the business is not going to ever go through the painstaking task now of building a business and have it take 18 years to get them anywhere. That person wants quick fix, fast money right away, and they'll be looking at a different career, I think, in the future.
Most likely.
There's going to have to be a lot less people in the business in the future than there is now.
Yeah. It seems to be inevitable, the only outcome that could happen.
Yeah. Well, the biggest generator of commissions in the financial retirement world is annuities, and most of the major companies have already said they're not going to allow any of that any longer. And so I don't know what the people who specialized in that, you know, now do the following morning. It's quite a drastic change. This is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. This is AM 790, your station for talking business. Thank you for joining us for 25 years. And yes, there are some of you who have been listening to the show that long. Thank you for the support all the years. Thanks for the brief encounters we've had at lunch over the years, Don and I. I guess our voices were obvious at Cello's, you know, having a hamburger. And we got to meet a lot of you that way over the years, and many have become clients in the office. It's been a wonderful 25 years, and we plan on continuing on, as you can see here. Monday and Tuesday night, Don Soa. Tuesday night, also his daughter, now her own very successful financial advisor. And so Don Soa, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, with his daughter joining him on Tuesdays. And I'm Steve Bove on Wednesday and Friday, and my son, Nathan, is here with me to talk about financial history on the program. We've been talking about all kinds of things, and tonight it's a name you all know, Warren Buffett.
And Berkshire Hathaway.
And Berkshire Hathaway.
Which many people don't know traces its origins to Rhode Island.
Yes, it does.
Way back in the day.
Hathaway was a textile company?
Even before they adopted the name Hathaway. Yeah. All the way back to Valley Falls. It was called the Valley Falls Company, which we'll talk about a little later. But, fascinating story. It goes way, way back, just after the Slater Mill. So, of course, Slater Mill was the first water-powered textile mill in North America.
Yes.
Which was, I think, was 1783, something like that. And
I used to have lunches on the lawn there with your mother when I was dating her.
That's right.
When I was 19. 58. That was a while ago, huh?
Yeah.
I used to meet her at downtown Pawtucket. She worked at a dental office and pack a lunch and never went out. Always had a bag and go sit on the lawn and have lunch together during her lunch break in downtown Pawtucket. Now, those two words, Berkshire Hathaway, boy, I mean, I've never heard two words before put together that sound so classy.
It has a nice ring to it.
It just does. It sounds like wealth, doesn't it?
Well, I think that has to do with the fact that it's been associated with one of the most prestigious investors.
But Berkshire by itself, the Berkshires are also a high end. Isn't that high end part of New York?
It's a part of England. Berkshire. Yeah. There's also the Berkshires the Berkshire Mountains, right? Western Massachusetts.
I think so. Yeah.
I was just there last summer.
Right.
Visiting.
Right. But yes, very few people realize that he either worked with the company. Now, did Warren Buffett actually work here in Rhode Island? Or just,
he's from Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Born and raised. But he got involved in the company in the 1960s. And actually a pretty funny story, how he came to own the company. He started buying shares in the company because he thought it was a good investment. And the president of the company at the time noticed that Warren Buffett was buying a lot of shares, and Buffett was pretty successful by that point, not nearly successfully as today, but the company, the president of the Berkshire Hathaway at the time, whose name was my favorite name of all time, Seabury Stanton. Just, if I ever run away somewhere.
Another rich-sounding word.
Yeah, Seabury Stanton, just a great name. Anyway, so he offered to buy Buffett's shares from him for like $11.50 or something like that, and Buffett said, okay, sure. Yeah, I'll sell you the shares for that. And he sent him the paperwork for it a couple weeks later. And in the written tender offer, it was lower than what they agreed him on. And Buffett was very upset that he said, we had an agreement and orally and agreed on this, and you're lowballing me, basically, you know. Mm. And he said, no, I'm not going to sell you the shares. And he continued to buy up the shares and until he gained majority of the company and fired Seabury Stanton. But he's a very humble man.
Yes.
And if you read his autobiographies and biographies, he talks about how the day he acquired Berkshire Hathaway, he realized that he had just made the biggest mistake of his life because he was acquiring a textile company which was an industry that was dying. He literally says the biggest mistake of my life was acquiring Berkshire Hathaway, which you think is like, well, how can that possibly be? It's one of the biggest conglomerates in the world.
It's no longer a textile company.
Exactly. Right. So he took the company in a different direction, obviously, and got them involved in insurance. Geico was the big holding that they first acquired that funded a lot of their future ventures. But they also own things, like Dairy Queen they own 100% of.
Seems like a very nice man, too.
He is. I saw him do an interview with Charlie Rose recently with Bill Gates. It was the two of them and Charlie Rose sitting down at the round table talking about the future and business and philosophy. It was incredibly fascinating. And Charlie Rose asked him, he said, Buffett was talking about how he does the best part of his job is he only works with people he gets along with. You know, if he doesn't like somebody, he just doesn't work with them. He doesn't have to. He said, I'm very lucky, he would say, And Charlie Rose said, well, what if someone came to you with this new thing that you thought was going to change the world and was an incredible investment and you didn't like them? Wouldn't you get involved? And he said, no. He said, he said something like, marrying for money is really not a good idea. And I can't think of any reason why it would be a good idea. But marrying for money when you're already rich is the worst idea.
Yeah. You get involved with someone, you may have a relationship there. It could get more entwined than you want it to be.
Right.
Ruin your weekends.
In other words, his position was, why? Why would I have to get involved? It's one of those investments that are obviously a very stable investment. It doesn't pay a dividend. They don't pay dividends at Berkshire.
Right.
But they're so diversified, and you just have so much faith in him and Charlie Munger. Mm. But the question that I always had was, him and Munger are getting old.
Yes.
What happens when they're not around anymore? And that could be tomorrow. What happens to the company then? I have no idea. That would be, if I was an investor in Berkshire Hathaway, that would be my number one question. What is the contingency plan for Berkshire Hathaway?
My experience in the financial business tells me that most of the time, not every time, but most of the time, when you see that kind of talent,
right.
When they leave, they know how to put the talent in behind them.
That's what you would think.
More times than not.
Right.
One thing keep in mind, if you've got real talented people in there, they're commanding a high pay, right? So it's in your budget, that high pay. They leave, you have to advertise to fill that spot. You already have a high budget item ready for it. So you also attract talent. So normally, my experience has been, I never thought in a mutual fund game, if you had a mutual fund that had a great record long term because of a manager, then the manager leaves, usually that fund continues to do well after that. Because who trained them?
Right.
The person who was number one, right? So why wouldn't you think they could be probably at least above average as well?
That sounds familiar.
It didn't happen with the Peter Lynch thing. When he left Magellan, it was never the same. That's because there probably will never be anyone ever again like him.
Peter Lynch, yeah.
He also made his heyday in the 90s when the market was infallible.
And a guest on the Money Talk program?
Yes, he was. He came in to see us in the beginning of the show. That's how long the show's been on the air. And he pulled up in an 8-year-old Oldsmobile.
Great.
Not a new car. His hair was a mess. And he looked you right in the eye, and he listened to everything you said, and he was the most just humble and wonderful person. You're going to find, I've noticed now in my time in the financial biz, that so often I've noticed people who end up with a lot of money aren't money people, meaning they're not obsessed with fancy stuff. They don't seem to have the new thing all the time, And I always thought if somebody is not interested in money but obsessed with it almost, it'll run away from you, I think. I think you have to handle it delicately in order to do well with money. I think it's a strange thing psychologically.
One of my favorite books I ever read to do with investing and stocks was Peter Lynch's book, One Up on Wall Street.
Me too.
Which is if you find stocks interesting and you like to buy and sell and trade, just even if it's whether it's for fun or whether it's for your retirement, I highly recommend checking out his book. It's just a great
timeless
book. That it is.
Is that the one where he said if you can't If you've got an idea for a company to invest in, if you can't draw it with a crayon, don't waste my time.
That could be that one, yeah.
Peter Lynch, yeah. Hey, this is Stephen and Nathan Bove tonight on the Money Talk Show, and we'll be back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business. Hey, you're hearing a lot of hype in the news lately about the good old USA stock market, up again today across the board. Year to date, the S&P 500 is up about 4%. Emerging markets are up double that, 8 to 12. We're not hearing a word about it. Keep it in mind because our industry, our country, our culture really is obsessed with the S&P 500. If you have anything other than a little bit of money, and you're not young anymore, then you need to have more than just the S&P 500 to have a proper portfolio, in my opinion. I do believe that you, if you're older and have a larger amount, then you surely want to have a global footprint. There's a lot of good places to invest outside the USA today. And year to date, we have emerging markets leading the way as the best market in the world so far this year. Let's take a look at Europe, see what they've been doing. Usually when rates rise in the U.S., while the rates are rising, usually what you have is emerging markets lead the way, and then the S&P would follow, and Europe somewhere in between. It's pretty a mixed bag, but emerging markets, we've been talking about that for quite a while on the program. It seems to be rising rates in the U.S. seems to really fuel that sector. When I began my career in a financial business many years ago, I was taught that 75% of the stocks in the world today that you can invest in are American companies. And decades later, it's the opposite. 75% of the stocks in the world today that you can invest in are not American companies. So take a look overseas. If you've been away from that for a while, I do believe that today it's a presence you want to have in your portfolio at all times. I do anyway. Preferred stocks, you don't hear too much about those. Just want to put a little bug in your ear about that. Here are some of the preferred stocks available. General Electric, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Emera, it's a Canadian company, Morgan Stanley. These are preferred stocks which are less risky than common stocks and all pay dividends in excess of 4%. In addition to that, if you own these stocks and you're in a moderate tax bracket and you invest in them outside of a retirement account, you can actually get a tax advantage on the dividend. Imagine getting 4 or 5% dividend on something right now when you look at what dividends are like. And a tax advantage. Preferred stocks are interesting. PFF is an ETF you might take a look at for preferred stocks or one of those individual companies, as I just mentioned. Berkshire Hathaway is a common stock, a little to no dividend.
Yes.
So it's a growth stock completely.
Completely. Well diversified stock. And like we were saying in the last segment before we went to the break, traces its origins to here, little old Rhodey here, which is really astonishing to me.
But at that time, little old Rhodey was an important part of our financial world in
huge,
America.
Huge, yeah.
At one time, really isn't now.
Northeast, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
right,
it was at one time, yeah.
But it was called the Valley Falls Company back then, and I'm talking way back, in 1839, this guy Oliver Chase founded it. And he had lots of mills all over the Northeast. He actually worked for Samuel Slater of Slater's Mill, but it was located near the Cumberland Town Hall. So if you're familiar at all with that area where Cumberland meets Central Falls, there's a park right there where right next to the town hall, and the river runs right past the park. And that park, that's where the Valley Falls Company used to be for decades. And across the river was another part of the mill that eventually became a senior living home, but it's a historical landmark today. But in 1929, it became known as the Berkshire Fine Spinning Associates because it merged with a Berkshire cotton manufacturing from Massachusetts. But unlike most New England textile companies, the company survived the Great Depression. Many of these textile mills went out of business, like most businesses. Most industries you looked at during the Great Depression suffered a lot of...
The ones that maybe didn't have any debt had a chance of surviving.
Right,
those kind of differences matter at times like that.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Anytime you have a great a recession like that, it affects... I mean, your industry, an 08 debacle. How many people in the financial advising business got out?
Left completely. Yeah, it was devastating.
Crazy. But by 1948, the company had about $30 million in revenue and employed 11,000 people in the country. It had 11 mills all on the East Coast. Then it became Berkshire Hathaway in 1955 when it merged with Hathaway Manufacturing Company, which was a New Bedford company, founded in 1888. By 1960s, the company started to downsize. It was down to 7 mills, 6,000 employees. This is when Buffett started to get involved in the early 1960s in buying stock in the company. He noticed a pattern in the stock, actually. Whenever they closed the mill, their earnings went up, I guess because they had got rid of some overhead.
Right.
And he started buying up shares. And then I talked about last segment how he calls it the worst mistake of his life because he became a majority owner in a failing industry, the textile industry.
And it's I would think it's less efficient to change the industry something's in than to start out by buying a business that's already in that other industry.
Right.
So it probably wasn't a great move, but it just goes to show you how, you know, overall knowledge and ability made up for it. He obviously did pretty well in spite of it.
That's right. So by the late 60s, Buffett was expanding into the insurance industry and other investments, obviously, but he bought the National Indemnity Company, which was located in Omaha, Nebraska, which is where he's from and where the company's headquarters are, and that is Berkshire's oldest operating subsidiary. In the late 70s, they acquired Geico and supplied most of the capital for other investments that they would have later on. But as of last year, they had Berkshire Hathaway had a total revenue of $210 billion, total assets of $550 billion, 331,000 employees. And like I said, Geico is a 100% owned subsidiary, Dairy Queen, Fruit of the Loom they own 100% of. Some of the smaller holdings they have are like Kraft Heinz Company, which they just purchased recently a significant share of.
Dairy Queen, there's one that makes me go, what?
Yeah.
Dairy Queen.
They own 100% of Dairy Queen.
Interesting.
Yep. They own
when a company that never goes public, it's not public if Berkshire Hathaway owns it all, right? They own all the public stock, or?
Some of them are public stocks that they own, and then some of them are not. Some of them.
I'm just thinking, if you've got a company that is crazy profitable, the first thing you do is you don't ever go public with it.
Sure.
People don't know that.
Right. Fidelity is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. Many of them, yes. If you have such a great model and you can run it within your family, why would you let the world in?
Right.
I wouldn't either.
But like American Express, they own 16% of Philips, 66 company, they own 14%. Wells Fargo, they own 10% of Wells Fargo. 10% of Coca-Cola, they have a stake in. But
I saw an ad for Wells Fargo recently in a major publication that was announcing that they would no longer allow any sort of sales competitions within their company.
Well, that's a response to what happened, the debacle they had recently.
I know, but I'm just glad to hear stuff like that. I always thought that, finance is like medicine. There really is no place for salesmanship in these two topics. It's too dangerous. It's too important to people's lives. I mean, if somebody, you know, sells you a pair of sneakers and they're no good, you know, all right, that's on you. You know, figure out how to buy sneakers right. You know what I mean? We don't need to regulate that.
Sure.
But healthcare and money, I'm all for it. And I'm one of the few guys in my field that's all for regulations in my business. I've seen so much good work done by others other than myself in the financial area around here. Many experience of good work. But I've seen some horror stories that I know if these laws were in place could never have happened. I have one particular one in mind. You know the one I won't mention. I'm thinking about. If the laws were such not then that they were now, that client never would have got railroaded.
You think about how vulnerable someone is if they retire and they've got a 401k of say $400,000, $500,000. That's all they've got to live the rest of their lives on. Think how vulnerable that is.
I know.
You know, and if they don't have the know-how, which many don't. Many, they work their whole entire lives at some trade that doesn't involve finance. I mean, stuff's complicated. I'm spending every minute of my waking life studying this stuff, and it's complicated.
Yes, it
is. You know, so
people
are so vulnerable in those positions that you have to have structures in place that prevent them from getting taken advantage of.
I agree completely. The case Nathan and I are talking about is a family member of one of my biggest clients who mistakenly talked to the wrong person and got 100% of their retirement money at age 65 put into a financial product that paid a monstrous commission to somebody who quit the job a month later and left them with a 9-year penalty period if they take their money out. 9 years beginning at age 65. Can you imagine how horrible. And they didn't even know that there was a surrender penalty on that account because it was sold so badly to them and it was omitted. And I offered to go after the guy. I know how to do it, you know. And she said, no, we'll just wait till the penalty's gone. And I've been working with that client for 8 years on a $500,000 account, advising them on it for free, waiting for us to be able to take that money out without a penalty. When I met her, Nathan, it was year two of the product, and the penalty was still, I think, 7% on $500,000. It was a $35,000 penalty if you want to move your money someplace else.
And the guy who sold to her is probably
not, gone.
Not even in the business.
Not even in the business. Gone, yeah. Well, that's why we need laws in retirement plans. So if you're getting correspondence from us or from other people in the area about this law, it is happening. It's not a scam to sell you something, and no one's going to make a commission on it. Matter of fact, we're trying to move to the point where there'll never be a commission earned again in a retirement account in America. I believe it happened in Europe a few years back already, or parts of Europe have already adapted it. Most people will do the right thing. I've been in this field for almost 40 years. I know who a lot of the planners are in the area. I know many of them. They're all my competition, and the vast majority of them are fine people. Unfortunately, if there's just one bad one out there, what if it gets you or your mother at age 67 and does a job on them, you know? So if you are receiving this type of correspondence from either our office or another office that you deal with, please respond to them quickly because there's a lot of heat to get this done. This is Nathan and Stephen Bove on the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back. That's the way you do it. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business. Nathan and I are talking about Warren Buffett tonight, one of America's greatest investors, and I think a very nice man.
Do you know how old he is?
72?
Higher.
Higher. Is he 80?
Higher.
Higher. I didn't. Well, tell me then.
He's 90 years old.
I only got a one-hour show here, son. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
90 years old.
Is he really?
Yeah, just recently turned
90. How about the woman we met in the office today? She was, what, 80? She was 80 or so. She was very, very young and articulate. And my dad's 84. He's doing very well. So you hear stories, and you hear other stories of... I had a client a few years back that got Alzheimer's very bad. He's younger than I am. In the 50s, that's sad.
Yeah, it's crazy. You never know what's going to happen.
Hey, Warren Buffett eats McDonald's almost every day.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, he absolutely does. HBO just aired a documentary on him maybe about a month ago. And the way his wife will curtail how much he gets at McDonald's is he has to tell her the exact change of the things he likes. And one of them's like, you know, two sausage McMuffins, and one of them is like one cheeseburger. And so when he gets into his car... In the change holder every day, there will be the amount that he's allowed to spend at McDonald's.
Wow.
Yeah.
For Warren Buffett, but let's not advise our customers
that's
to eat at McDonald's.
That's what I'm
saying,
right? 90 years old on McDonald's?
Yeah, wow. Maybe he ate it for so long his body's used to it.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's crazy.
Last time I had a McDonald's hamburger, I felt like I was going to die.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Once every 2 years or so, in a pinch, I might do it, but it's not good, I don't think.
Those sausage McMuffins, man.
Those are good.
Those are good.
Yeah, in the morning.
Those
are
good, yeah.
But I didn't know he was over 90.
He is pretty ancient. That's good as ancient as it gets. He came from a family that was involved in finance. His father owned a brokerage firm. His father was also a U.S. congressman for a few years in the 1940s. But his first business venture was at age 11. He bought three shares in a company called City Services. And in high school, he bought a farm, 40-acre farm, that was worked by a tenant farmer. And he owned the land, and the farmer paid him rent.
But, amazing.
Yeah, he went to, obviously, many people know he went to the Wharton School. He enrolled in the Wharton School of Business, but dropped out after 2 years and attended the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He said he was pressured to attend Wharton by his father and then realized that this is not worth the money. He says, I don't need this, and dropped out. He did graduate, but not from Wharton. He graduated from a state school. I graduated at 19 with a bachelor's in business administration and was rejected from Harvard Business School. Didn't get into Harvard. Imagine that.
Right.
But they regretted that decision.
He also, not to interrupt or try to one-up you here, Nate, but I did just watch that documentary.
Yeah.
So he bet against his teacher's pension plan in high school.
Yeah.
He, like, sold it short or whatever.
Yeah.
And every time it would move in his favor, he would go and remind his teachers that he had bet against them and their pension plan. So he would be making money. Obviously, you guys know how it works.
It sounds like he has a little bit of an edge to him I wasn't aware of. Antagonistic a bit.
And when he was... This is the last one. Don't worry again. Not trying to steal your thunder. But when he was rejected
can I turn
from Harvard,
his mic off?
He basically met with the Harvard guy in, like, Omaha or something. The Midwestern rep went out there.
Yeah.
And apparently, he just looked like a mess. And he was late, and he was squirrely looking, and he didn't really have any of his ducks in a row, so they said no. And he went back and was trying to figure out what he was going to do, and he was reading this book, who the two guys, names I don't remember, and he thought they were long dead, these two economists. And when he realized they were alive, he called one of them up, and he said, "I just realized that you wrote my favorite book. I thought you were dead, but you're alive, and you're teaching at Columbia." And so that's how he ended up at Columbia.
And that was probably Benjamin Graham.
There you go. Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah, Benjamin Graham, who wrote the Intelligent Investor, one of the most famous books in finance history, was a professor at Columbia, and that's how Buffett got into insurance. Actually, was on the board of directors at Geico, and he met Benjamin Graham that way.
Aren't those commercials fantastic?
Yeah,
Geico commercials.
They're great. Yeah,
I'm sure it's just an insurance company.
They go
no
back
different.
Now too. You could think like.
Oh, the caveman.
Like, that was a long time ago. I mean, they've
10 years?
Had tons of more commercials since then.
Hilarious.
Yeah, hilarious, yeah. Just...
And we like to laugh, I think. I think we remember companies like that make us laugh, you know?
Yeah.
I do.
He Buffett taught an investment principles class at his local university. He was big into education back then. Today, he still is now.
But fairly priced education.
Yeah, fairly priced.
That's me, too. I believe in it, too, at a fair price.
However, he said the average student was twice his own age. He was very young when he was teaching. Mm. But in 1954, he began working at Benjamin Graham's partnership, which I was talking about, this famous investor back then. He had started off about $12,000 a year, which is about $100,000 today. Mm. But in 1956, Graham retired, and Buffett started his own partnership. He purchased his home in Omaha in 1956, which he still lives in today. And he operated five different partnerships back then, and he became a millionaire in 1962.
He's probably got a 13-year-old Oldsmobile or something like that. No.
Right, I'm sure.
Hey, I have to say this only because it's so unique, and I mentioned it briefly already about the spot at Slater Mill in Pawtucket, and I believe my wife is listening tonight, and hopefully she'll enjoy this. 35 years ago, you're what, 33?
Yep.
Yeah, so about 35 years ago, Mom and I were having lunch on that lawn, and imagine if she had said to me, "Stephen, 35 years from now, your son and you are going to be hosting a financial radio show here in Rhode Island and talking about this spot." Can you imagine?
No.
I mean, just how life is so wild like that. Whoever would ever have thought that I sat there, her and I sat there having splitting a tuna sandwich many, many years ago, and here you and I are now talking about it, and she's at home listening to us talk about that spot. What a riot.
What a wild time.
Thank you for your great history lesson again, Nathan.
Thank you, Brett,
too. Thank you also for your contribution. We love it. Any of our listeners, anytime you got something to add like that, please feel free to chime in. We'd love to hear from you. Tune in tomorrow night for Don Sowa right here on AM 790, your station for talking business. To the great big world.